Hello and welcome to the podcast, What We Teach Our Children. I'm Kim Clyden. How do we nurture creative, connected, resilient, emotionally intelligent and empowered children? And they say it takes a village, or what we might call today a community. So if you're feeling overwhelmed by the responsibility, you're not alone. We're surrounded though by people who can support us, your family, friends and professionals, who all play an influential role in shaping our children. Children are our future, and the very existence of the human race depends on what we teach them. Imagine if your parents, teachers, relatives, or carers told you another story. Your life story would be completely different. I believe we can change the narrative for our children, but to do that, we need to change our story. This podcast is about everyone who plays a role in that story at every level of society. January 2025 heralded the release of the Australian Government's first National Autism Strategy. The highly anticipated report lays out, and I quote, a vision for a safe and inclusive society for all autistic people in line with international human rights. The goal? To improve the quality of life for all autistic people in a way that is meaningful to them. Lofty ambitions considering the vastness of the autism spectrum. Understanding autism is key to raising awareness and creating that safe and inclusive society. As far as I'm concerned, it means speaking to people living with autism and also caring for those who are affected, all of whom will tell you a different story unique to them. Raised on a property in rural Australia, Mandy Jeppesen is ever grateful for the farming lifestyle. Now raising two boys on farm, she credits her father for her hard work ethic and appreciation of nature. Qualities, she says, that form the foundation of her grit and gratitude. Mandy, you would have experienced freedoms and responsibilities that many people growing up in a city don't have. What was your life like on the farm?
You know, we grew up going yabbying in the creeks. Dad used to take us up to the dams and go bird watching. We'd go up, walking up in amongst the hills and look for caves and things like that. Just getting out and enjoying those sorts of things. That was probably the best part, I'd say.
They say that we model our parenting on our parents. So what do you think you took away from them that you've applied now in your family?
Always being there for the kids, no matter what, is a big part of that. Being always on hand to help, doing things for them without them needing to ask because you preempt a lot of those requirements. Just being someone that they can always turn to when they need someone.
How did you end up in a country space as an adult raising a family?
I actually went to uni, did ag science degree and majored in animals. Was really hoping to get back into beef cattle again. But when I finished university, that was when the DPI at that stage were doing big cutbacks. So I ended up getting a job in sugar as a research assistant and never left. Met my husband and we settled on the family farm and had our two boys.
Did you meet your husband through work?
It's a funny story, actually. In around 1998, sugarcane disease smut was detected in the Ord River. And so anyone who had gotten machinery or parts or things from the Ord had to be visited on farm just to check it all over, make sure that it hadn't come in any way. And that's how I met my husband. And it was the long-running joke that, you know, it was smut that brought us together and smut that kept us together.
Haven't heard that one before, so that's definitely something that's unique to you, I think, and Tony.
Definitely.
When did you have your children?
He's my eldest, is born in 2007, and Ben was born 2 years later, 2009.
How has it been raising those two boys, and what's been the most surprising thing about having a family for you?
I had very little to do with kids growing up, being as remote as we were, and then you sort of get chuffed off to boarding school. You never have that opportunity to be around babies and toddlers and things like that. So it was a bit of a shock, first up, to have this little thing relying on you and not getting enough sleep. And I suppose the biggest thing for me was that loss of freedom. You couldn't just do what you wanted to anymore. Your life being dictated by these two little men. So that was probably the biggest challenge to overcome, and it still is, really.
with Sam?
If you talk to his teachers and his daycare mum from when he was real little, he was an absolute terror of a kid. Like, just did everything that you didn't want him to. That later on came back to a diagnosis of ADHD and Asperger's. You know, once we had some sort of diagnosis there, we could put together a bit of a treatment routine. But those early years with him were really full on.
So how did that impact having a second child?
We always knew we were going to have more than one child. And Ben came along 2 years later, and it was, in our minds, just a natural progression to have another child. Having Sam the way he was, his symptoms weren't as evident when he was really, really young. You know, not having that experience with little kids, you just assume that that's what they were like. With Sam, the difficulties didn't really occur until he got to primary school. And then, you know, we sort of came into management mode trying to help him adjust. Not having that background, sort of there was nothing that really set you off to say, okay, well, maybe there's something else going on here. That was something that we just had to work out later on.
Did Ben display any similar symptoms at birth?
No, Ben was a normal baby, normal milestones. I don't think he slept more than 2 hours at a time in that first 12 months. He was a terrible sleeper. But up until, he was a normal baby up until about 14, 15 months of age. And then he was weaned. And within 2-3 months, he had lost eye contact. He would not respond to his name. He lost any speech, stopped eating a lot of the foods that he was eating before, and just regressed in a big way. And initially we thought it might be a hearing problem, but when we went to get the hearing test, they had a lot of trouble getting him to respond to the noises that they were playing through the headphones, and they said, no, this isn't hearing, this is behavioural. So that's when we went on to the paediatrician to try and, get some sort of diagnosis or some answers as to why he was the way he was.
Did you?
At the time, there was a really good assessment team at Queensland Health, and we took him to get assessed through them. So they had speeches, they had OTs, paediatricians. It was just a really good setup. When he was about two and a half, we got a formal diagnosis of autism, and that sort of set the wheels in motion as to, you know, where we went to from there.
I can't believe there was such a sudden change. Have you been able to establish whether it was something in the dietary change or whether it was something that was a physical environmental change?
The only thing that we could sort of put it down to is that dietary change. My way of thinking, and this is just my personal opinion in terms of autism, is that a baby's born with it. It's already there, whatever it is, and it takes some sort of external force to cause it to show itself. So with some people, you know, they will tell you that it's when the baby had an immunisation. It could happen when the baby is born, some sort of trauma. But with Ben, it was when we weaned him. So whether it has something to do with that loss of the antibodies or something that was in the breast milk that he was no longer getting, that was the trigger to cause that to come to the forefront.
How did it make you feel at the time that your son, who by all accounts had been a perfectly healthy baby, had now become someone so disconnected from you?
I think at the time we were sort of thinking, well, maybe it's something medical that we can get addressed and get it fixed and things will be good again. Because at the time we knew very little about autism. When you find out you're pregnant and you want to start a family and things like that, that's not something people talk to you about, which I think is very sad, because you need to be made not scared but aware of potentially what could happen when you have a child. And with the prevalence of it, I really think that there needs to be a conversation with parents going forward as to this could be a possibility. Can you prepare yourself for that? At the time, it didn't really put up too many red flags because we were already having so many issues with starting to see a lot of issues with Sam. And Ben didn't have those behaviour issues. He actually withdrew. And it didn't really hit home until he started to get a bit older and we realised that there were a lot of things that he was not picking up, and there were a lot of, you know, those those steps in life that he just wasn't reaching, and that was going to be a major issue.
Researchers have identified there may be a DNA or genetic connection to these types of diagnoses. Were there any indications within your families that, you know, that this could have been an issue when you started having children together?
Not at the time, but I think the more that I learned about autism and Asperger's, the more I could pick up things in pretty much everyone that I knew. Every single person, I think, just has that little bit of autism or Asperger's in them, whether it's, you know, something that they do or whether it's how they act. But it's not something that you pick up on until you start to go through it yourself.
I know you don't want to say it, but did you see it in your husband?
Yes. But I saw it in myself as well, so we're pretty even there.
Well, I'm really scared to ask this. Do you see it in me? Because I know what I have, but I'm wondering if you see any traits in me that might indicate I'm on that sort of scale.
No, probably just the amount of energy you have. I wonder.
It's called ADHD.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. It's more the ADHD side of things.
It's not just an energy. It's this frenetic thing that goes on in my head. It's neurodivergence part, you know, of many people. And I think the more we recognise traits, the more, like you said, we do see them in other people. How has that helped you in this quest on, you know, trying to find people who will identify with your boys particularly?
I suppose it's helped me be a lot more accepting of people, whereas before they would just annoy me or you would just write them off and not want to spend time with them. But you can identify now that they are on the spectrum or at least, you know, have those tendencies.
As mothers, we often have to go out in public with our children and people looking, judging and sometimes even verbalising their disapproval of behaviour. So I'm wondering, you know, how did you manage as a mum of these two young boys who both had very individual needs in public when you had to go shopping or on holidays? How do you cope with that?
Well, very early on, Ben could not handle crowds, he couldn't handle noise, just all that stimuli of going out. So usually I would have to get someone else to actually look after him while I went shopping. Another thing with him too is he's an absconder. So the moment he can take off, he will do that. And it doesn't matter what's in front of him, whether it's a road, whether it's a crowd of people, he will spy something and just go walking straight towards it. And he is very quick and very quiet. So you really need to watch him all the time. Sam is the opposite. He was a very loud kid. He was actually pretty good in public. Whenever he gets excited, he just talks. So you always knew where he was. But having both of them made it very difficult because especially with Ben, it was easier and less stress on him as well as myself to get someone to actually look after him so that I could go out and do the shopping or whatever.
Well, how much support do you have given that your family doesn't live in the region?
Yeah, that was probably the most difficult part is that we were so far away from family. My husband's family does live in the region, but they had their own kids at the time. And with my kids the way they were, Sam wasn't too bad, but Ven was very specific that he wanted me all the time. So my dad actually, when he retired from the property, moved up onto the farm. And because Ben got used to him being around, I could actually leave Ben with Dad, which made things so much easier. There were other mums in the area that had little kids around about the same age, but none of the other mums had kids that had the same issues as my two boys did. Sam wasn't too bad. He was a very outgoing kid, so he could go to play group and play and things like that. Ben was not. You would take him and he just wanted to get away from everyone. So you'd actually spend most of your time walking around the cane paddock because he just wanted to get away and go for a walk.
How have you faced the challenge of education then?
Anyone who knows us knows what they're like. You know, they know my two boys. Sam now, he's matured, he's left school, and you wouldn't even know that he has Asperger's or ADHD. I think as he's grown older, the way they express themselves have changed. When he gets excited, he still talks a leg off an iron pot. I think that'll always be the case. But he's managed to develop that self-control and knows ways of managing those behaviours, which is fantastic. Ben, on the other hand, he's getting there. You know, he's a teenager now and he's starting to interact a lot more. In the last couple of years, we've seen that, which has been great. But it's been a very long, long time coming for that.
Speaking of management, what types of management tools or skills or even medications have you been offered through this journey, and what's worked?
With Sam, with his Asperger's and ADHD, we did use Ritalin for a couple of years just to try and help him through sort of those last years of primary school, early high school. He just got to a point where he asked, you know, can I go off it? Because it would, he just wouldn't feel hungry all day. So he'd have the medication in the morning and it would work up until about 2-3 o'clock in the afternoon. He just wouldn't eat and it made him feel terrible. So I think it was about grade 9 or 10, he went off the Ritalin and has been really good ever since. We've never had any medication with Ben at all. His behaviours are manageable through things like occupational therapy, speech therapy. So we've obviously seen a lot of therapists over the last few years to try and get him to the point where we are. It took 10 years to toilet train him. So it wasn't until he was 10 that he actually got out of nappies. So that was a big thing to get to that point. He still needs one-on-one care. So we have support workers. We go through an agency and the support workers are pretty much with him one-on-one wherever he goes, whatever he does. At home, we need to know exactly where he is at all times. So we've got a big fence around the yard that gives him the ability to go outside and walk around without us worrying about him escaping, which he has done in the past, and having dams and creeks and everything else when you have a child that, you know, he's had swim lessons his whole life, but he just doesn't have that ability to get the front moving at the same time as the back. So he's either paddling with his arms or kicking with his legs. It's just a worry all the time.
What do you think has driven you to continue and make sure that, you know, your boys have the best?
It was Tony and I that made the decision to have kids, not the boys. So you have that responsibility to raise your children and provide them with all the skills that they need to be able to function in the community when they're old enough to go or you're no longer here. So, you know, that comes back to what I learned growing up. You have responsibilities and that's what you have to look after. When I was growing up, I look back now and I think, geez, I reckon I had Asperger's, undiagnosed, especially through high school. I had a lot of issues in high school, social issues more than anything. So you can feel empathy for the kids and the frustrations that they must have. And I suppose you have that desire to help them. To support them any way you can. If they have an issue, you're looking for ways to actually help them resolve that. That's just been the driver the whole way along, you know, and letting them have a life where they enjoy, no matter what their abilities or disabilities are.
What plans do you have in place for if and when either you or Tony can't be with Ben 24/7?
The big thing for us has been that we don't want the responsibility of looking after Ben to fall squarely on Sam's shoulders. So with his support workers that we have, we're trying to get a good base there across a number of different groups and people so that he's got a good support base for a number of people he can call on as he gets older and who know him. That's probably the hardest thing, is finding good people who are willing to stay in the industry is very difficult. In terms of, you know, we have a cane farm. The aim is for Sam to take over that farm when we retire. He can't run a farm and look after his brother at the same time. So having Ben, love him to death, but it has really reduced our ability to do a lot of the things that we wanted to do. And so we don't want Sam having to go through that at the same time. We've just purchased part of the neighbour's farm. It has a house on there with a small acreage around it. That will actually be put into trust for Ben. So he will have an asset then if he needs to go into full-time care later on. Sam doesn't have to foot the bill for that. He can sell that portion off and use that to fund it. We're looking at setting up a disability trust for Ben as well so that he has funds aside in there for his care as he gets older. So there's a few different things that we're sort of putting in place to try and make sure that there's a buffer there for when we're no longer able to look after Ben.
So his disability is permanent and will not change?
I think there may be certain aspects that will over time, but he's not gaining any new skills, but then he's not losing them either. So we found a really good dietitian because Ben has pica as well. Pica is a compulsion to eat non-food items. So it's often been reported on in women who are pregnant, you know, the old pickles and ice cream thing that you always hear. Ben would eat foam, he would eat rubber, he would eat timber, pretty much anything that he could tear off and swallow. And on the other end of the scale, he would only eat about five or six different foods, and they were usually white, processed, highly salted foods that he felt safe with. About a year and a half ago, we found a really good dietitian in Brisbane, and he actually set us up so that we knew what steps to take to slowly introduce new foods and get him accepting of, you know, he never ate fruit or vegetables. He wouldn't eat meat. His protein intake was almost non-existent. Now we've got him eating yogurt. He's drinking chocolate milk, and he's only ever drunk water since we weaned him. Apple, carrot, you know, all these different foods. We're up to about 20, 25 or 30 different foods now. So he has the ability to learn new things. It takes a while, and I'm not sure how much more we can gain going forward.
How much ability does he have to take care of himself on a day-to-day basis? What functions does he perform on his own autonomously?
He pretty much has to be asked to do a lot of things. So when he's eating, it might take him an hour to eat a meal because he's just sitting there, loves looking at videos on YouTube, you know, the Wiggles and High Five and all that sort of stuff. And he just gets so focused and absorbed on those that you have to remind him to, you know, take the next bite. He can bathe himself, but he has to have someone in there making sure that he does it. Otherwise, he'll just sit there and spin around under the shower for 20 minutes. Washing his hair, he's still sort of learning, you know, brushing his teeth, that coordination needed to do that still needs to be developed a bit more. He can dress himself, he can undress himself. So the basics are there. It's just developing it. We're getting to the age now where he has to shave. Well, try and that's a whole new thing that we have to try and teach him to do.
How old is he?
He'll be 16 this year.
Wow.
Mm.
Must make you proud, though, to see him get through these challenges, adopt, you know, certain behaviours and abilities and not be where you thought he could have been.
Oh, absolutely. You know, when you compare how he is now to what he was when he was three or four, he's interacting with people, he's speaking. You know, a lot of the speech that he has is one or two word answers. And it's not really an interactive conversation that you're having with him, but he's talking, he's still communicating. And early on when he was unable to do that, it caused a lot of frustration for him. But on the other hand, he's taught himself five or six languages from using Translate. You know the subtitles they use on the Wiggles videos?
Yes. Yeah?
He will sit there and he's taught himself Cantonese and Italian and German, and the other day it was Portuguese.
Wow.
And he just can pick it up like that.
So that's his superpower.
That's his superpower. And he will sit there and make all these videos with subtitles and, you know, record himself and superimpose him in front of the Wiggles and just makes all these videos. And you just think, how amazing is the brain that he can focus and just do such amazing things like that? And yet
physically
can't remember to flush the toilet or wipe his backside or, you know, there's just such extremes when it comes to it.
What would you like people to understand as you've become able to understand through this process?
People have their own idea in their head about what autism is. What people don't realise is just how it is so different from one person to the next. You can have someone who is high-functioning, who, you know, might have a couple of things that you sort of pick up on and say, oh, that's a bit different, but really can function as a person from day to day. And then you have other kids that just sit in a corner and don't interact with anyone at all and just hyper-focus on one thing for, you know, 24 hours a day. That's the spectrum that you're dealing with. So what may work for one child will not work for another one. And that's sort of the big challenge when it comes to treating autism, is that every treatment protocol is different for every person. There's none of them are going to be the same. I've found that people are far more accepting of autistic behaviour in young kids than what they are in teenagers or grown-ups, because there just seems to be this way of thinking out there that as they get older, they get better. People will mistakenly think that the way their brain works is the same way that other person works because they're grown-ups. Whereas really, I reckon Ben will be watching Wiggles videos for the rest of his life.
More power to him.
That's right.
I still like watching cartoons and some kids' shows on Nickelodeon. What's wrong with that?
That's right. He loves dressing up in costumes and that will continue probably his whole life.
Oh, you should get him into cosplay. I know people who love that sort of stuff. He'd find his own crew.
That's right. I think the Wiggles really need to invest in some adult size costumes.
That's a great tip. I love it.
Marketing campaign right there. That's right.
I want a Wiggles adult size skivvy and pants, please. I love it. Mandy, you've been an absolute treasure to speak with today. Thank you so much for sharing your very personal story and for allowing us to live inside your world, even if it's just for a moment.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for asking me.
Oh, she's a character. Farmer and agri-extension consultant Mandy Jeppesen in the studio with me today, helping us understand the trials and tribulations of living with autism. Did you learn something helpful today? Well, don't miss the next episode. With more than 290,000 Aussies diagnosed with autism in 2022, that was a 41% increase from 2018. Now, one in 40 Australians are estimated to be living with autism. And it seems the rise in the statistics has a role in the strategic approach we mentioned at the beginning of this show, set out by the federal government. So what does acceptance look like? And how do we move towards social change built on a foundation of inclusion? My guest next week works on the front line of autism and national disability support. She also identifies as an autistic and neurodiverse individual. Don't miss that conversation. What We Teach Our Children is recorded in Launchpad Studios thanks to Split Spaces, a nest for new ideas.